Hi, my name is Lauren Templeton, and you are listening to Investing the Templeton Way. This podcast is for anyone interested in learning more about investing. In this podcast, I will be interviewing some of the greatest minds from the investment community and exploring topics ranging from international markets to behavioral finance. To learn more, please visit us at investingthetempletonway.com. The information presented in this podcast or available on the website is not intended as and shall not be construed as financial advice. This podcast is produced for entertainment value. Investing is inherently risky, and I encourage you to seek financial advice from a professional who is aware of the facts and circumstances of your individual situation. Thanks for listening. So first, I would like to welcome everyone to the Investing the Templeton Way podcast. I'm very excited to welcome my guest today, Vitali Katsanelson. Welcome, Vitali.
Lauren, thank you very much. Thank you.
Yes. So a little bit about my guest. He was born in the Soviet Union. He is an American economist and investor, and he's the author of several books on value investing, including Active Value Investing, Making Money in Range-Bound Markets, The Little Book of Sideways Markets. And today we will discuss his most recent book, which is called or titled Soul in the Game. Vitali is a frequent contributor to several financial websites and publications. His investment philosophy stresses investor psychology, fundamental analysis, concentrated diversification, value investing, and contrarian mindsets. Since 1997, he has worked at the Denver-based Investment Management Associates. So welcome again, Vitali, and I want to start with a congratulations on the success of your new book, Soul in the Game. So can you tell me, what does it mean to have soul in the game?
Lauren, thank you. So Soul in the Game is a kind of a chapter in the book that was so important to me, I decided to name the whole book after this. There are so many ways to explain it, but let's talk about what is soul, what is the game. The game is something that fits one of the three criteria. Is there something that you do spend an enormous amount of time doing every day, like your occupation? Something that is very meaningful to you, that could be one of your hobbies, or something that has impact on other people. So therefore, whatever you do will have impact on others. So this is what the game is. It's one of those categories. For me, the game is being an investor, a writer, a parent. So those are my games, and I have to have soul in those games. And soul means, in this case, where your whole identity tied to this game. So one of my identities is an investor. One of my identities is a writer. One of my very important identities is being a parent. So, and when you have an identity tied to something, then the activity has all of you. Every single ounce of you is poured into it. And therefore, when you are involved in this activity, you will never compromise on quality. You will never do anything that would be harmful. And money, when it comes to, let's say, in my case, like my money management business, is always a secondary consideration. It's never a primary. I'm doing investing for the love of this, because something, I wake up in the morning and I look forward to discover what I'm going to learn next.
I see. In the investment community, we use the phrase skin in the game a lot. You point that out in your book, but this is really a step further.
Yes.
Soul in the game is really being passionate about your pursuit. It reminds me a lot of the concept of noble purpose, which John Templeton always talked about and wrote about and felt that people should live a life of noble purpose. It reminds me a lot of that. So it was interesting to see that you wrote about Soul in the Game, or titled your book Soul in the Game. I have enjoyed reading about that. How do you go about developing Soul in the Game?
First of all, you need some luck. I mean, you need to find, like now I'm talking about your profession or your occupation, right? You need to have an occupation which you absolutely love. And if you have that, then it's a lot easier to have soul in the game than if you're doing something that you are indifferent about. But that's how it started.
How did you find a profession that you loved? You have such an interesting background, and I would love for you to share just a bit about your childhood with my audience, and then how you found yourself in the United States, and also how you found your way to investing.
So Lauren, I was born in what I used to call Russia. Now I'm so embarrassed for that country that I just say I was born in USSR. But I was born in Murmansk, Russia, and Murmansk located up northwest, if you like, above the Arctic Circle. It's a very, very close to the kind of the northern tip of Norway and Finland. So it's very cold, long nights during the winter time, very, very short days. And my family immigrated to the United States in 1991, and we came directly to Denver. So I received all of my kind of all my education, high-level education in the United States. I went to CU Denver for my undergraduate and graduate degree in finance, and I got a CFA, you know, while I was doing my master's. So I stumbled into investing. This is why I say luck is important, you know, because I think I dated 6 or 7 different majors in my first few years in college. And it's a, like, you know, it's a date, right? Because you try it out, you don't like it, you you move on. And like even for a while, I even contemplated to be a lawyer, because when I was going to school, it was during O.J. Simpson trial, and being a lawyer at the time was very, very cool. So for about
we have
months,
that in common. You know, I also wanted to be an attorney. And I got my first job in finance, and I can remember my boss telling me, that's fine, go ahead and apply to law school, but you're not going to want to go when this is all said and done. So that's interesting. So you dated several different majors. Was your family supportive of this? Wondering?
Yes. Well, no, I think, like, you know, that was before I was married, and I lived with, you know, it was my parents. And I was just, you know, I was taking business classes. And I knew I wanted to be in business, maybe in computer science, but, you know, so I, you know, I tried, you know, I took different classes, you know, and none of them clicked with me. In fact, I remember taking a management class, and after, you know, because at that time I thought, okay, I'm going to major in management. And when I took after I was done with the class, I came up with my teacher, and I was genuinely thankful to him that I realized I don't want to be a manager. And I told him about this, and he actually got upset at me. But I was, you know, but he did such a good job explaining what managers do that I realized that that's not something I want to do. I took finance class, and I also, this is where luck comes in, I got a job at an investment firm, and they hired me because I was good with computers. So they just completely hired me for computer skills. And while I was taking finance classes at CU Denver, I ended up talking to portfolio managers about, you know, who work for this firm, about investing, etc. And I realized this is something I really, really like. And let me tell you how much I liked it. I would take classes, come home, and I would talk to my father for 20 minutes, 30 minutes about what I learned that day. That's how I knew that I really, really loved it. And so at that point, once I realized this, you know, I want to do, you know, I want to become an investor, I just, you know, set my goals to finish graduate degree, an undergraduate degree, then graduate degree in finance, and get my CFA. And so I was lucky that I got this focus very, very early in my, you know, my life, you know, when I was in my 20s. I basically, Warren Buffett, you know, I think he wanted to become an investor when he was 5, probably. I don't know, maybe 10. So I forget. Yeah, but, you know, he was born in this country and I wasn't, so I, you know.
Sure. I tell young people something very similar. I think, you know, often young people come to you for advice and they're so focused on finding their passion. And I'm like, just go get a job. It will work out because you're going to learn what you don't like. And that's just as important as learning what you do like. And you will eventually end up where you're supposed to be. And there is a good deal of luck in that, that we can't plan for. And so that's interesting. That's the way you found your way into investing. I love the way in the book that you lovingly speak about the relationship with your father and how important that is to you. My listeners may not know that you have a wonderful investment letter that you send out, which is a great read. And on every letter, there's a painting that your dad painted. Can you just tell everyone how they could read your investment letter and a bit about the relationship with your father and his paintings?
Sure. So I have to kind of go back to my life in Russia a little bit. So my mother passed away from brain cancer when I was 11 years old. And it's very difficult to find an upside in your parent passing away, but there was a silver lining that it really brought me a lot closer to my father, because I was so shocked by losing my mother that I was paranoid about losing my father as well, and that made me at first it's almost like feels forced, but it's made me appreciate my father a lot more. And when I got older, the sense that he won't be here forever, motivated me to spend more time with him. So for a long, long time, I would go and go for breakfast to his house 3-4 times a week. We would travel abroad in the United States all the time, and we have a very, very close relationship. And so my father has a PhD in electrical engineering, and he taught electrical engineering at the Murmansk Marine Academy for 28 years. He also had a hobby all his life. Since he was 7 years old, he liked to paint, and so he painted all his life. He's 89 today, so he painted since he was 7. So when we moved to the United States, my family was really concerned about my father, because he was living in Russia just for me and my brothers. So we were concerned, when he comes to the United States, what is he going to do? Because he was 58 years old. He would not be able to teach. His English was not good enough to teach. And luckily, he basically just embraced his hobby, painting, which was hobby at the time, painting, and became a full-time artist here. And for a long time, he would actually sell his paintings. He doesn't sell them anymore. But that's how he earned a living. So Lauren, I started writing in 2004. And after a while, I started writing for thestudio.com, and I would send out my articles to my friends. And for a while, I started to include my father's art in it. Mm-hmm. One day, I forgot to include my father's painting. And I got a few semi-angry emails saying, Vitaly, your articles are okay, but please don't send them out without your father's paintings. And I learned my lesson. And since then, when I send out my articles, they always have my father's paintings. And actually also started to include my brother Alex's paintings as well. Oh. So if you go to contrarianedge.com, you can subscribe to my articles, and you'll start getting my articles, which will include my father's paintings. And also, as a few notes about classical music.
Great. We will make sure and put that in the show notes so the listeners can go back and learn how to subscribe. I do enjoy seeing your father's paintings. It sounds like there's a lot of creativity that runs in your family. If your brother is an artist and you are somewhat of an artist, I mean, you're involved in very creative pursuits. Writing is a creative pursuit. Do you see any of those talents in your children?
My son has this thirst for knowledge, just very similar like my father does. My middle daughter Hannah is a very, very good good artist. She paints, and my father taught her. My youngest daughter Mia, she's 8, almost 9. She taking piano lessons and really, really likes it. So who knows? So she has my mom's talent because my mom played violin.
Any hope that the children will go into investing in the book? You talk about this, that maybe you're holding out some hope that the youngest might go into investing, but that the other two have not expressed an interest in it. Tell me a little bit about how you have approached investing with your children.
Okay, so there's an update since the book came out for that. Okay, so my son, Jonah, is the oldest. I wanted him to become an investor. So I would lecture at CU Denver or DU, Denver University, maybe a few times a year, and I would take him with me. And he would, diligently sit in the back row and listen to my lectures. Though I have a suspicion he was just playing on his phone all this time while he was sitting there. But I was hoping maybe something will kind of rub off on him. And, I took him to Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting maybe when he was 15 or 16. And he told me basically said that I have absolutely zero interest in investing. And the way I approach this, I want my kids to be happy. Would I like him to become an investor? Yes. Well, investor, absolutely. But only if that's what he wants to do. And I don't want him to become an investor just to please me, because it's his life. So I really want them to be happy. So I want him to do what he really like falls in love with. However, and for a long time, he basically said, there is absolutely no way I will be, I'll do investing. So he's a student now at CU Boulder, and he took accounting class. And to his shock, he did not hate it. And then he took a finance class, and he actually liked it a lot.
Wow.
And he got the highest, he had the highest grade out of like 150 kids, he said, I tried so hard to do any other major than finance, but it seems that that's what I really like.
That's great. There's hope for you yet. My dad always says to young people that you can't opt out of the money game in life. So even if you study finance for just a year or two, it will benefit you for the rest of your life. You've got to understand the money game and how to play it, no matter what your profession. So that's very exciting. My guests should know that the book, even though you're a well-known investor, the book only speaks about investing very tangentially, and that you talk a lot in the book about parenting and making parenting decisions. It seems like you're a very thoughtful parent. I love to hear that you've taken your son to Berkshire Hathaway. Have you taken your daughters?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, as you know, I took mine last year and went to your book signing, and it really was a fun trip. What I like about how you write about parenting in your book is, in this profession, I feel like when I first entered into investing and finance, I really almost hid the fact that I was a parent. I just didn't want anybody to sort of know that I had kids, really. And then I found that was unsustainable, and that the only way to continue in this profession was to bring them along with me. And quit making excuses for being a mother, that there are a lot of mothers in the world, and it's okay to bring your kids to conferences and let them see what you do, and it's not unprofessional to be a parent. So I love that you've really taken the opportunity to write about parenting in this book. Is there anything else you'd like to say about parenting your children and how that all intertwines with investing?
Well, first of all, I would argue this book is about investing. But it's the most investment, the most important investment you ever make, investment in your life.
Yes.
So it's just a different investment. No, so I think you're absolutely right. I think you shouldn't be hiding away from being a parent. And I think it probably actually being a parent probably makes you more thoughtful. because you get to look at life now from a different perspective. And I think being a parent, this was probably one of the most important things that happened to me, because it made me so much more mindful, so much more grateful. And I would argue that my kind of IQ and EQ increased by 10 points just because I started to look at things from a slightly different perspective. Mm-hmm. As a parent, what can I say about, no, I think parenting is probably the most important job I will ever have. And you and I will ever have, mm-hmm. Because that's really, kind of our kids is the kind of our message,
It's a long-term investment.
Yeah, no, it's our message to the future, that we may or may not be able to read, So I don't, I'm glad you're not hiding away from this, and you shouldn't. You have great kids.
Yeah. I mean, it's particularly being just a female in the industry, I think it was hard to embrace that. But I have, as you know, fully embraced it. The girls come with me on a lot of different trips. And that's, I think, COVID, going through the COVID pandemic and doing so much stuff online, you really see a lot of parents, not shying away from that and showing their family life and acknowledging the fact that family life is very important. The investments you make in your family are some of the greatest investments you'll make in your life. And you also talk about that in your book. One of the subjects of your book is stoicism, which is so interesting to me. You sent mm-hmm. me an email a few months ago from a colleague, an expert in stoicism, and the article was about John Templeton and comparing some of his writings to some of the major beliefs in stoicism. So tell me about your journey into stoicism and what has attracted you to that, and that explain that to my audience, please.
Yeah. First of all, let me talk about that person. First, you're referring to Donald Robertson, who wrote this phenomenal book called Thinking Like a Roman Emperor. And this is probably one of the best books on stoicism you can read. And it's basically kind of biography of Marcus Aurelius, who is one of the most important stoics out there. So stoic philosophy is a philosophy that's about 2,000 years old. When I say the word philosophy, it's usually turns people away because it usually sounds very clinical and these phrases that are too difficult for normal humans to understand, etc. But all philosophy means is a kind of love of wisdom. And Stoic philosophy started in 2,000 years in Greece, and there are basically three kind of pillars or three teachers of Stoic philosophy: Epictetus, who was a slave; Marcus Aurelius, who I mentioned, who was a emperor of Rome, actually; and Seneca, who was the Renaissance man centuries before Renaissance. He was a playwright, he was a senator, he was a banker. He was advisor to the emperor. Lauren, what really clicked with me about Stoic philosophy is that I read this quote by Epictetus, and which basically said, some things are up to us, some things aren't. And you read this and it sounds like, so what? Well, then he tells you what is up to us. Up to us are so few things. It's basically, it's how we behave and what our values are. And I guess what we think. Everything else is not up to us. So now if you start looking at, this is called the dichotomy of control. Once you realize that you have so little control over things, you're going to start going through life and look at things differently. You're going to realize that when you drive to work and every traffic light has a red light, you realize there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. So you're going to start stressing out about it. When you go to the grocery store and a clerk is rude to you, again, you realize, so what? You can get upset about it, but did you really expect to go through life and make sure and expect every single person you meet to be kind to you? Probably not. Anyway, so that's what kind of grabbed me, got me interested in Stoic philosophy, and then I basically realized why Stoic philosophy is so important to me and why I decided to dedicate almost one third of the book to Stoic philosophy. And the reason is very simple. When we are born, we are basically born as this, as a hardware and software. This hardware, we all come with a similar hardware. And the software-wise, from an operating system perspective, we basically have a blank slate. And then our parents help to write our operating system, our friends, our circumstances, books we read, kind of experiences we have. But our kind of our operating system is kind of almost like Winchester's house. It's a randomly written to us. So what Stoic philosophy did for me, it provided an operating system, kind of a very well-organized operating system that helps me to go through life and minimize negative emotions and therefore kind of increase the quality of my life.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It does remind me a bit of John Templeton because he believed in thought control. And I remember one day he said to me, "Lauren, when I encounter a negative thought, I banish it into the nothingness that it was." And I'm like, "What? Okay, that's interesting." But it shows you how you paid careful attention to his mind and his thoughts. And really banishing negative thoughts. He only wanted positive thoughts in his life. So how do you go about practicing this on a daily basis? I mean, your book talks about taking cold showers. I thought about trying that this morning, and then I decided that was a little too painful for me. And I know that's just a little thing you do in your life to practice this, but tell me about how you organize your day and how do you practice Stoicism in your life?
Can I push you a little bit?
Yes.
Yeah. If you and I were talking and I said, "Lauren, let's, you want to try skydiving?" You would have a very good argument saying Vitaly.
I've done
it. Well, so good. Okay. I couldn't do this. So let me flip it on myself. I'm not going to skydive. And because there is a tiny, tiny probability that I can die from that.
Right.
It's a very tiny number, okay? But at least I have that to justify this. Okay, what's your justification to accept discomfort of not taking a cold shower?
No. Because I don't want to be uncomfortable.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. So there is no, at least there is, there's no threat to your life, right? You just try to avoid discomfort. And here's the interesting part. I like discomfort as much as you do. So, but I train myself, I turn on cold shower, I stand in front of it, and I realize, I realize that I don't want to do it. But then I think, okay, so once I walk in, once I get under the cold water, I'm going to be uncomfortable for about 30 seconds or less. And then I'll get used to it. And then I'll look at this as, I overcame one of my fears. So this is what goes through my mind. So, and that's why I do this, because I kind of train myself of doing things that I don't like doing, even though they're harmless.
Yeah.
And they taking cold shower, there's a whole bunch of, health benefits, but which we don't have to go into. But that's kind of why I do cold showers.
Yeah, it reminds me of yoga, staying in difficult poses for a long time, sitting in your discomfort, doing things that are uncomfortable. It's what it reminds me of. And so much of your book also reminded me of Arnold Vandenberg. I don't know if you've ever run across him.
Oh, yeah. We talked about 2 weeks ago. Yeah.
And, he practices yoga and your book reminded me of him for some reason. I think I experience the same when I'm playing tennis would be the way I think about it. I'm very uncomfortable playing tennis. Tennis is a mental game and it really just shakes me to my core to play tennis with people. I have a very hard time with it. Not the physical part, but the mental part. I'm so hard on myself for missing a shot or, oh my gosh, I'm so embarrassed about things. And it's a really good practice for me because it puts me in very uncomfortable positions. And I think I've grown as a person and an investor from that. And then, as you know, as a value investor, you're constantly putting yourself in really uncomfortable positions. It's never fun to go in and buy at the bottom of the market. I mean, even I'm very accustomed to it, and I know you are too. And we learn to anticipate the reward on the other end of buying at the bottom of the market, but it's never super comfortable. Do you find that stoicism helps you with your investment strategies?
Yes. Let me tell you why. Because Stoic, the academy of control we talked about, what it teaches you that you really want to focus on when you play tennis. Let me give you an example. As we play, when you play tennis, when you play tennis, you have very little control either you're going to win or lose, but what you have control over, how much you practice, how much you practice and how well you practice, right? So you have a control over that as a process, right? But when you play, you have absolutely no control where the ball is going to go, how it's going to bounce, if you're going to trip, this kind of things. So, which reminds me of investing, right? Because as an investor, you and I have a control over our research process, of how rational we are, of our analysis. But we have absolutely no control how the market decides to price our stocks and when it decides to price, to which levels. So there is a lot of similarity from that perspective. So the Academy of Control should be taught as a 101 in a course in value investing, because that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, it is so true. I mean, I always tell young people, as you know, you've heard me say it, that my dad put me to bed with the stories of magic of compounding, and compounding mm-hmm. is magic. There are two factors. There is the length of time, the time and the rate of return. And we have not as much control as people would think over the rate of return, but we have a lot of control over the time component. So just focusing on that and starting young is a great advantage to people. But yes, it sounds like stoicism is very applicable to investing.
And let me answer your other question about, kind of stoic philosophy is a practice. Mm-hmm. And it's there's a Asian proverb, knowing and not doing is not knowing. And if you think about stoic philosophy, even if you read my book or learned other books about stoic philosophy and you learned it and you don't practice it, it's almost like not knowing. And the reason for that, because when you practice stoic philosophy through daily encounters, through daily exercises, what you're trying to do, you're trying to rewrite your behavior that has formed for decades. That is a long process. And by the way, you're going to fail a lot. And when you fail, you should be kind to yourself. And you just, when you fail, you recognize you failed, learn the lesson, and move forward. By the way, that applies to investing, that applies to playing, tennis or anything.
Can you give me a practical everyday example of how you've used stoicism in your real life? Maybe something that you've failed at and a success story as well.
Okay, Lauren, I'm going to go back to 2 days ago, which actually I ended up talking. I went on Twitter and talked about it. So this is a fairly public embarrassment. People can go on a website and reach out my firm that they're interested in investing with us, okay? And this happens all the time. And, a person reached out to us on Sunday, and I rarely respond to this email because somebody else takes care of this. But the email was kind of addressed to me, and it was extremely condescending, it read something along the lines, if you send me your books, I'll read them. If I like it, I'll become a partner. I may become your partner, kind of thing. It it's really irritated me. Mm-hmm. And so what I did, I called this guy and I said, this is the rudest email I've received in a long time. And I don't want you to be our client. And I kind of hung up, okay? So that was my failure as being stoic, okay? Now, what I learned from this, my God, there are so many lessons here. Number one, you don't do anything when you're angry, period. This is something that, we've been taught as kids forever. But But that's part of the, you know, that's part of the Stoic philosophy as well. You don't do anything while you're angry. So what I should have done, at least I should have come up with a plan of action a day later. So I shouldn't have responded when I'm angry. That's point number one. Point number two, it was completely up to me to frame that as an insult. In reality, this is just words that, you know, that came to me in the form of email. And it, you know, your uncle would have just rephrased it as being neutral, because mm-hmm. he would not let them come, you know, come into his mind as negative. Well, you know, there was a guy who basically, you know, wrote these words. They did not have to be negative. You know, I took them as negative. They didn't have to be negative. So if I framed them as neutral, then I would not even have to deal with anger, right? Because, you know, my reaction would be rational. That's point number two. Then also, there's a whole bunch of other Stoic techniques. I could have looked, instead of getting, you know, I could have imagined this person, like, as a, like being somebody who maybe 15 years old, 13 years old is trying to get a book out of me, right? Would I really be angry at this, you know, 13, 15 year old? No. Mm-hmm. So when you go through life and you encounter something that makes you angry or makes, you know, kind of, you know, or it's up to you to, first of all, what Stoics would call a pre-emotion, to look at this emotion that about to come and reframe it, turn it into a neutral emotion or positive emotion. And then also, then you can calibrate your response as well. So you, like, I go through life and I get the Stoic tests, like, you know, like the one I got a couple of days ago, and I fail a lot, but I succeed as well, a lot as well. And every time I go, you know, kind of, I take this little test, even when I fail, if I learn from it, chances that probabilistically over time, I'm going to fail less and less. You know, that's basically just an example of a failure.
Yeah. It sounds a lot like impulse control too, right? So the ability to control your impulses. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm very guilty of, responding right away to an email, but then I get to the end of the email, I've finished writing it, and I think, I better not send that. I'm going to delete that email and let it sit for a few days. And if I still want to send it, it'll be there in my drafts. And I'm normally, like, a huge percentage of the time, never send the email. So impulse control is really important when it comes to investing as well.
Yeah, but it's more than that. So they you write it because that's lesson number one. But another one is that I chose to frame it, and this is like one of the first Stoic concepts. I chose to frame it as a negative email. Mm-hmm. It didn't have to. It was completely up to me to interpret it as negative. If I interpret it as when you drive and somebody cuts you off, right? You know, you become angry at this person. I'd say you, in general sense. The thing is, if you think about it, this person does not even know you exist. This person may be running late, you know, home because the babysitter is about to leave, or whatever. You don't know what's going on in this person's life. And you can interpret it as that person has been rude to you, and therefore you can take it personally. Or you can just, you can just basically interpret it as somebody's running late somewhere and what they did is really not a big deal. Do you see what I mean? So it's the impulse control is one of the lessons, but there is a lot more than that. And I think this is what I love about Stoic philosophy.
Yeah, framing is super important. I'm constantly talking to my kids about that. You know, if somebody's mean to them at school and they think, mm-hmm. oh, they're mean to me, I'm like, well, let's reframe that. Let's think about, you know, what could potentially be going on in that child's life and how this probably doesn't actually have anything to do with you whatsoever.
And Lauren, you know the best part? While you're doing this, you're almost training yourself, don't you? Because
Well, isn't that what parenting's all about?
That's exactly right. When I told you that I got 10 extra IQ points from being a parent, it's for that reason, right? Yeah, because you learn so much more when you teach others.
It's so true. You know, just going back to parenting for a second and a fun little tangent in this conversation, but you do talk about it in the book, is how much you ski with your kids. And I know also that you have a small group of value investors that you meet and ski with. Can you tell me some fun stories from your ski trips and value investing?
I think skiing is probably one of the most important things that has happened to my oldest son. And let me explain why. When he was born, he had asthma. He still has asthma. And he was, he spent last first 4 or 5 years just kind of raised by my wife, meaning that I would go to work and he would spend all the time with her. And she was so, she was so shocked that he had asthma and it was so dangerous that she kind of smothered him with kind of very motherly love, which is a good thing. But the downside of that, he became very, very timid and afraid of things. That's kind of the downside of that. And so my wife, does not ski, which, I was upset, I wish she did. But then I realized there was a silver lining in that.
Yes.
So when I took my son skiing, it just was him, just two of us in the mountain. And therefore, that motherly love that tried to protect him from everything was not there. And he had to, I'll give you an example. It took him, 3 to 5 days to get on the bunny slope. And bunny slope is the easiest slope there is. And then it took me another, few more days to convince him to get on a kind of a normal lift that would take him to green slope. It was the first weeks of him, learning how to ski was torturous on me and him. And then over time, he learned how to overcome his fears because, he learned how to ski on green slopes, then on, kind of icy slopes, blue slopes. And today, he is one of the best skiers on the mountain, period. He is incredibly good. And he does, he's much better skier than I am. And he does slopes that I would not even dare doing. But that has shaped him tremendously because that has kind of overcompensated somewhat for the fear he had. And now he does things that are he was in Hawaii and he swam with sharks, this kind of thing. So
everything a mother hopes for. Just kidding.
No, that's right. Yes, absolutely. I don't think my wife knows about it. So, about the sharks. Yeah. But anyway, so that's what skiing did for us. And then that tells you how different our kids are. My middle daughter, who is 5 years younger, so she was learning how to ski basically the same time my son Jonah did. Jonah was 9 or 10. And she was 5 or something, she was 4 or 5. And on the same bunny slope they took Jonah, 3 to 5 days to go down from, on the very first try, she was going down and she sees there is a bump. She turns and goes on the bump just because she had absolutely no fear.
Yeah,
and
she I talked wanted to her catch about some air.
Well, you know what? She said, Jonah was so, she saw how scared Jonah was. She wanted to prove that to him that it's not as scary. That was her. That's just how different our kids are wired. Same parents. But anyway, I have a conference in Vail, which I actually hosted in the summertime. So there is no skiing. But I do go to a conference, Value X Clusters, which is a small village outside of Zurich. I've been going there for now, started going maybe 12 years ago, organized by my friend Guy Spear. And so I've been doing, I really enjoy, I'm sure you do too, I know that, just getting together with other like-minded people, and talk about investing. I mean, that's probably the best, because this is why I like going to Omaha, because when you talk to other investors about value investors, about stocks, etc., there is a lot of shorthand that happens, right?
Yeah.
We already have, when we talk about a stock, we are not talking, we know that price volatility is not really a risk, but just actually a feature, of investing, and that the real risk for us is the is the permanent loss of capital. So it's a when I talk about other other investors, other value investors, I just love those conversations because I get to it's almost like we have our own vocabulary of and that's a lot more efficient.
I love it too. I come home so energized from all of those trips and conferences and excited to re-engage in my work. It's a wonderful thing. I can't get away as much as you guys can though, because I feel like I'm always, it's hard for a mom to pack up and leave and leave the kids home and coordinate sitters and school and all of that.
Well, I have a lucky, my wife doesn't work. Well, I mean, well, I shouldn't say that. My wife works
very hard,
but very hard. But her occupation is my kids.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that? Do you see how I said it in a very politically?
Well, it's true. It is a total occupation.
It
takes a lot of time. Scott and I are both hands on deck. As you know, we work together, and so we split it all, which can be, difficult and messy, but it's definitely a joy. So you go skiing with this group of value investors. Are you exchanging investment ideas? Do you like to listen to other people's investment ideas, or you're just networking?
So I go for all of the above. I love skiing. I love listening to other investment ideas. I love, one thing I learned about conferences that a lot of times you learn not when you listen to investment pitches, but when it's kind of this white time between the between the presentations, when you are on break and talking to somebody during break or on a ski lift, or like in clusters we go out for these long walks, and we just talk talk about live, books, investment ideas, this kind of things. So that's why I go. So it's over time I started to go because, I have created, built a relationship with people. And now I just go to rekindle those relationships.
Yes. And you do not diet on these trips.
No, that's right. No, and yes, absolutely.
My listeners may want to know a bit about that, but you talk a little bit about self-control in your book and about how that you don't eat desserts, but you do allow desserts while you're on business travel. And can you say a word about the structure and discipline in your day and the way you think about that?
Yeah. So when I'm in Denver, I don't eat desserts. I don't eat almost any flour products. I don't cookies or pasta or bread. And I don't eat red meat when I'm in Denver. However, when I am outside of Denver, and the airport counts, like Denver airport counts, once I pass the security, has been outside of Denver. I have no diet, none. So anything I want, I can eat. And I'll tell you this, Lauren, I kind of calculated at some point that I travel for business or pleasure either about 8% of the time, about a month a year. Like we go on family vacations or go on business trips, etc. Mm-hmm. So 8% of the time, I can eat anything I want. I can have ice cream every day. I can have steak every day, whatever I want. And I'll tell you this, there is a certain quality in the scarcity. Like when you have something all the time, imagine if you had steak or ice cream every single day, you would not value it very much, right? Because you get used to it. But when you have ice cream, once every couple of months or a few times every couple of months, you're going to enjoy this ice cream so much more. So when when I'm in Denver, let's say sweets for me become what I call a half binary decision. Binary would be 0 or 1. Half binary would be 0. So when somebody offers me dessert or cookies or candy, I just say, I don't need dessert. And then it became a kind of part of my identity. When I'm in Denver, I don't do this. Therefore, I don't have to make a decision. If it's half binary, it's a non-decision decision. And therefore, every decision you make, even when you wake up in the morning and you try to figure out what dress you're going to put on, or in my case, what pants I'm going to put on, that takes a certain amount of energy. If you think about Einstein or Mark Zuckerberg or some other, Steve Jobs, they kind of wore the same clothes all the time.
Yeah, they're well known for saying, I have a limited amount of decisions and emotional energy I want to put into that. So all the clothes are the same. Do you believe in that?
Oh, absolutely. So this is why, so there is the fewer decisions I can make during the day, the more willpower I'm going to have. Mm-hmm. There is absolutely decision fatigue. My wife drives me crazy, but I literally have 5 pairs of jeans, like that, they're identical. Mm-hmm. That's all I wear. In the summertime, I just wear shorts. And I have, a dozen t-shirts that are from our conference in Vail. And that's what I wear throughout the year. I'm lucky that if I was 20 years ago, it was harder to do this because people had a certain standards for the way you dressed. But I think over the last 20 years, those standards declined to almost nothing. So today I'm wearing a t-shirt and jeans, nobody cares. Plus it helps that I run the firm, so I get to decide what I do.
Yeah, it's interesting. I believe in all of that. That's one section of the book when I was reading it, though. Like, I do believe in decision fatigue and a limited amount of willpower. For instance, I always work out in the morning because if I don't work out in the morning, I'm not going to do it. That's when my willpower is greatest. I believe, that diminishes throughout the day. There's plenty of evidence to suggest that. But just on these decisions, like I don't eat dessert. I understand that. And I think it works in some cases, but I think sometimes people are perfectionist and life can't always be perfect, So your rule of having dessert and eating anything when you travel, you have to give yourself grace to make mistakes too. Because if you don't do that and you mess up, it's so devastating that you'll just quit the whole process of eating healthy. So does that make sense, what I'm trying to say?
So I think what I do, it's very important to understand the context of this book, is that in this book, I'm sharing my way of approaching things. It doesn't mean that they universally apply. However, when you and I talked about cold, you don't want to do cold shower, right? But you do something similar with tennis. Mm-hmm. So you're doing it you're doing what I'm doing, just you're doing it with tennis. And what you do in this tennis doesn't apply to me. But you overcoming an obstacle, that's all you're trying to do. With tennis, I do it with cold showers. I find that I have a very addictive personality. Mm-hmm. If I have to make a decision, I usually lose, meaning that my wife makes this wonderful pancakes and she said, just have a half a pancake. I said, you don't understand. If I have a half pancake, I'm going to have 5. I have no willpower. This is how I'm wired. You may have willpower where you don't need to do this. In the domain of cookies or sugar, you may be fine just to have one, half a pancake and have enough willpower not to get another 4.5. I don't. So this is why I have to do this, because I know that in this domain, I'm very, very weak.
Yeah, well, so my husband is the same way. He will eat a dozen cookies. He just can't have one. And he's like, I cannot have one because I will eat them all. self-control.
Well, exactly. So the way I exercise my self-control is by going into half binary mode. Then it's almost like, and I tell a story in the book about a friend of mine who is a rabbi. And, he's an Orthodox rabbi, and Orthodox Jewish rabbis don't eat pork. It's just, that's the given. And he was at my house, and he was telling me how much, that he has this weakness for bread, and he gained a lot of weight over the last, couple of years. And I said, well, just become a person who doesn't eat bread. He said, how can I do this? I said, well, don't you do this all the time? Because if I offered you a little bit of pork, would you eat this? He's like, no, I'm a person who doesn't eat pork. I'm going to say, well, just become a person who doesn't eat bread. Mm-hmm. You know, and he did actually. And he lost like 30 pounds.
Yeah, it's identity, just, right? He identified as somebody who didn't eat bread.
Exactly. So it's a, what's interesting is that with what I realized is that when I did this kind of 8% diet, at first I was concerned that when I came back from travel, I would kind of like after I had steak or bread, etc., I would fall into kind of, I would continue having steak or bread. But what happened with our mind is kind of interesting. I read stories, and this is maybe a little bit extreme, but when American soldiers came from Vietnam, a lot of them actually in Vietnam, they were addicted to cocaine and other drugs. But when they came home, a lot of them actually completely shook off that addiction. Because a lot of it, it's a kind of domain dependent. A lot of our bad habits, or habits in period, I shouldn't say, you know, Kevin Brad is not a bad habit, but are domain dependent. So I trained my mind to think that when I'm in Denver, it's part of my identity that I don't eat bread. When I'm outside of Denver, I eat bread. And so when I come home, it's very easy for me just to stop eating bread again. So there is something to domain dependency.
Well, what's very clear to me after reading your book and also interviewing other well-known investors from around the world is that good investors are very disciplined and they're very conscious of their thoughts and their habits. Now, there are differences and now all of them, you know, but it is very clear to me how much thought successful investors put into organizing their time, the way they think. They all tend to be very disciplined people. That's one thing I've noticed for sure, is that the level of discipline. So that is something that comes across in the book for sure. When you're exercising this discipline in your investment process, is that why you're attracted to value investing? Because it is so disciplined in nature that there is actually a process to adhere to?
I was interviewed a few days ago and I was describing what value investing is. And the person said, Isn't just investing? And I said, yeah. It is just investing, right? Because Warren Buffett talks about it all the time, how value investing is kind of a redundant term. Mm-hmm. And so I think, but to answer your question, I think this is like what I like about investing, that's how process driven that is, right? How you try to do the same thing over and over again, like applying to different companies, you know, different countries, etc. But if I had to kind of dumb down my process, it would be, I want high quality companies. I want to identify companies that businesses which I understand. I want it to be high quality, and I want to buy them cheap. And that's kind of, you know, and nice thing about it that every single time I encounter a new company, there's something else that is new. The process is the same. I just kind of go through these three steps, but there is something new about it, which makes it not stale and interesting. And I learn something every time. But at the same time, I still have to, at the end of the day, I still have to come up with have to determine if I understand, if it's a high quality, and how much the company is worth. Then I can figure out how much I want to pay for this and for the stock. And just keep going through this process, you know, every single day.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a manager, I'm going to ask a tough question, but I've given a lot of thought to it. You are so careful with your thoughts, the discipline, the processes you use when you analyze companies, but you also have to have the right partners as investors. And I know you've given a lot of thought to that. I found it very interesting in your book that you don't accept capital from your best friends and people really close in your social network. We don't have that as a policy, but it's It's not written out, but we definitely have that policy here. It's a gift to myself. I mean, I want to be able to, you know, go out to dinner and not bump into anybody and have a peaceful Saturday night when I'm out with my family instead of thinking about talking about investing when I bump into an investor that happens to be my next door neighbor or something like that. But tell me about, you're so controlled. How do you know when an investor on the other end is the right match for your company? How do you control for their behavior? You've been so careful controlling your own. How do you control for theirs?
So the way we do marketing is slightly different from others, is that people read my articles for a long, long time. And where I discuss many different things, I discuss parenting life, but I also talk a lot about investing. And people reach out to us who like our investment philosophy, who find that that investment philosophy clicks with them. And when either myself or my colleague has a conversation with them, we basically tell them, for you to be a good client for us, for this relationship to work, we need three things from you. You need to buy into our philosophy. You need to have a long-term time horizon. And then you need to do your homework. And being our client actually comes with a homework, because 3-4 times a year, I write letters to clients. And a lot of times they're like 30 pages long, like 30 pages, you know, single space, you know, letters. And for this relationship to work, you need to do your homework, because in these letters, I basically download my best thoughts about the portfolio and explain how I think. Because my goal is for this portfolio to stop being Vitaly's portfolio and become your portfolio. What I find is that, Lauren, you and I can do our best job trying to make sure we have the right clients. But and I think doing what I'm doing, you know, that's a very good filter, because people who want fast returns don't come to us.
Yeah.
Now, but here's what I found. There is an empathy gap. People who, I remember a client who became a client came to me and said, Vitaly, I wish market would decline 30% because I want to buy more stocks. Like, I'm like, you know, great. So the guy came to us, we signed him up as a client. We only got maybe 30% invested of his portfolio. The market was down 10%, and he was freaking out. Okay, and he wasn't lying to us. There is an empathy gap. You know, there is a difference between what people think their tolerance for volatility is and the actual tolerance.
Yeah.
All I try to do, all I can control, is that, like, you know, kind of how, you know, what we communicate to outside world, people we attract. If I'm talking to somebody and they can clearly see they're not a good fit for us, we'll tell them that, and we will just will not take them as a client. But what I found is that even after we took what we thought was the right client, the person may not be just suitable to invest in stock, period.
Yeah. I mean, that's very common, I think. And we find that not only with investors. I think we've perfected the way we speak about our strategy, and, you know, having trouble as opportunity displayed everywhere in our office does a good job of that as well. But we find that not only with investors, but also employees. I mean, it's very easy for these analysts to come in and they cite all the books and, you know, they can tell you how to build all the models and they believe in value investing. But when the rubber hits the road, do they really have the psychological ability to go in and buy in a down market, or at least stand pat in a down market? And I find that there's often a disconnect there, which is why we don't employ analysts. But for my listeners who are wanting to learn more about your investment strategies, your books, your newsletters, what is the best place for them to go to learn more about you?
Sure. About the book, if they go to soulinthegame.net, soulinthegame.net, if they buy the book, they can actually get their instructions there, how they can get new chapters that I already wrote after the book came out. because I keep writing this book.
It's going to be long by the time you get to the end of your game.
Well, because because I keep learning, right? So I'm working another chapter right now for, which is probably already like 12 pages long. And anyway, so soulinthegame.net, where they can learn about the book and get additional chapters. Absolutely free, by the way. Those additional chapters, absolutely free. And then if they want to learn about my firm, they can go to imausa.com. But I would just advise them, don't even check out my firm. Just subscribe to my articles, on contrarianedge.com. And then read my articles, or if you have a podcast they can listen to, which is just basically my articles read to them. And if they go to investor.fm, they can just listen to my, to my articles on tape, basically.
Awesome.
And then, so that's what I would do.
We'll have all of that in the show notes for listeners. And I have so enjoyed your book, and there are parts that I want to go back and reread. I have listened to the audio version and have screenshot a few of the time logs so that I can go back and listen to a particular part. There's actually one screenshot that I did this morning because I want to go back and replay it for my daughter because I want her to hear what you said. And
could ask you which one, if you remember which one.
Well, I can tell you the minutes where you're talking about education and a point in your life where it all came together for you. And that I think you had quit smoking, you decided to focus on education, and you put in a lot of work. It was at the 6th hour and 33 minutes there. So this is how I have to memorize things. If you look at my phone, Vitaly, all you see are screenshots of books, page numbers, things like that, because I can't remember it any other way.
Very smart. Very smart. No, I think it's very smart. Yeah. By the way, like the what you're referring to, I observed it so much with my son. It's very interesting. My son Jonah, who's 21, so today his GPA at CU Boulder is 3.97. Which is incredible.
Yeah.
Lord, when he was in 11th grade, his GPA was 1.3, and he matured like between his 11th grade and 12th grade. In his 12th grade in high school, it was 3.9. It just, one thing I learned about kids, they all mature at different time. Like I was a very late bloomer. I think I matured in my 20s. I was lucky that my son matured when he was 17 or 18. And that now he's this thoughtful young man. I'm looking at him. He's, so much more thoughtful than I was his age. So to all those parents who listen to me, whose kids are kind of giving them a lot of heartburn today, I think we need to remind ourselves that we all grow up at different pace. We all mature at different pace, and
and we're still growing, right?
That's right. Yeah. I'll tell you this: I'm a different person today than I was before my kids were born. Like I have so much more self-awareness. I'm so much smarter than I was then, just because kids make you smarter.
They do. And I appreciate your time. I'm so glad things have worked out with your son. It gives me hope for my daughters. And I plan on making my oldest listen to that portion of your book. I'll replay that for her. I want to thank you again. This has been so enjoyable. And to tell everybody to go get a copy of Soul in the Game by Vitaly Katsanelson. It's a great read, and I think you'll enjoy it.
Lauren, thank you very much. I really enjoyed our interview.
Awesome. Thank you, Vitaly. Thank you for listening to Investing the Templeton Way. Please be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast player. To view the show notes and resources mentioned in today's show, head to investingthetempletonway.com.